With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On Christmas night, 1996, six-year-old JonBenet Ramsey was murdered in her family's home in Boulder, Colorado. A ransom note was found in the home, but it was hours before her father, John, found her body in the basement. She had been strangled with a garrote and her skull was fractured. The media sensationalized the tragic death of the child beauty queen, and public speculation and rumors ran rampant. What followed was one of the most notorious unsolved murder investigations in American history. Boulder police fixated on JonBenet's parents as suspects. Needing investigative help, the Boulder DA brought in legendary homicide detective Lou Smith. However, he was soon disenchanted with law enforcement's obsession with the Ramsey family as the primary suspects, excluding other possibilities. Smith resigned but continued to work on his own time and at his own expense, determined to find justice for JonBenet. He determined the Ramsey family was not involved in her death, but died in 2010 before he could identify the killer. Thousands of people attended his funeral service, including John Ramsey and the detective's lifelong friend and colleague, John Anderson. Along with a handful of retired detectives, Anderson and Smith family continued to pursue justice based on Smith's work. Now, for the first time in Lou and JonBenet, Anderson tells the story of Smith's investigation and why the Smith family team now believes that the killer can be identified. The book that we're featuring this evening is Lou and JonBenet, A Legendary Lawman's Quest to Solve a Beauty Queen's Murder, with my special guest author, John Wesley Anderson. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, John Wesley Anderson.
Thank you, Dan. It's a privilege to be with you.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this extraordinary book.
Well, thank you. I accept that on behalf of the team. There was quite a significant team over the last several years that have been involved in making sure this book was out there and that the truth was known.
You write about that, what you wanted to do with this book, what you intended, the three things that you hoped that this book would produce. Could you tell us about that briefly?
Yes, thank you, Dan. The purpose of the book is to do three things, is to get the truth out there. There's been a lot of misperceptions and untruths about the book. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to communicate the belief that Lou Smith had that no member of the Ramsey family was involved in any way in the death of JonBenet. And that's been established, I think, in the book beyond any reasonable doubt. But the third thing is to encourage particularly law enforcement to accept the fact that this case is still solvable. The DNA is good enough that it can identify who the killer is. It can show who the killer is not, and it can exclude people of interest that have been brought up in the case, such as the Ramsey family.
Let's get right away to this fascinating story that you have here, which includes this, your mentor, Lou Smith, Andrew Lewis Lou Smith, born 1935 in Denver, Colorado, entered the Navy at 17 and married his sweetheart, Barbara, four kids, Lori, Cindy, Mark, and Dawn, and became a cop in 1996. And he called you Johnny. You were 18 years old working at the Identification Bureau in Colorado Springs Police Department. This was 1972. Tell us about Andrew Lewis Lou Smith, what you already knew about him. What was his already his background that you knew about? And tell us about the relationship that you gradually and eventually developed with Lou Smith.
Happy to do that. One minor correction, just a slip. The murder was in 96. Lou began his career in 1966, on the Colorado Springs Police Department. And I started in 1972, right out of high school. I wasn't old enough to be a police officer. In Colorado, you have to be 21 to be a police officer to make an arrest or carry a gun. But at 18, I was hired full-time by the Colorado Springs Police Department as a cadet. And for the most part, we were given administrative jobs. I worked in communications, evidence, the impound lot. I worked in the identification record section, was my first job for a year and a half. And that's where I met Lou. And at the time, the Detective Bureau was just down the hall from the ID Bureau, records identification. And whenever detectives needed to see if there was a mugshot on a person or if they had a record or any fingerprints in file, they came to the identification ID Bureau counter, and cadets as well as civilians would ask the detectives, what is it that you need? And Lou really stood out from the very first times I've met him there. He was so thorough, so engaging. He was just a very polite, humble man. And so I really enjoyed that interaction and went out of my way whenever he asked for something that was related to a case. In the middle of the night, we worked shift work. So in the middle of the night, I'd often read the unsolved cases. And when Lou would come in, I'd talk to him about those cases because he always worked unsolved murders, what we today call cold cases. And so when he filed a report, I'd go through his supplemental reports to see how he detailed an interview or an interrogation or a search warrant. And he clearly stood out from the other detectives. Just, he was so thorough. And he became kind of an early mentor or role model for me.
You said that Lou Smith believed in this Locard's exchange principle or the transfer theory. Explain that.
Yes. Professor Locard from Lyons, France, was the first one who actually documented this theory. Then there's a couple of different names, transfer theory, the exchange theory. But basically, the point it gets across is that whenever a crime is committed, the suspect either leaves something at the scene and or takes something with them. And that exchange, it's almost a triad between the suspect, the victim, and the scene. And the stronger you can connect those three points through physical evidence, through interviews with witnesses, through statements, confessions, through interviews with the victim if they're alive, the stronger your case becomes. And what Lou would do is he would go to extraordinary depths to prove that transfer theory and document extensively, well, what was taken from the scene? What might the suspect have with them in his possession if we get a search warrant? What did he leave at the scene? And so that fundamental understanding and application of the transfer theory is something that inexperienced detectives just may not have a good understanding of. But Lou really understood even beyond that is after he retired from the Colorado Springs Police Department, he went to work for the coroner's office and the district attorney's office. So he understood the medical legal side of death investigations, homicide investigations, worked a number of major cases there. And he had experience in over 200 murder investigations to include an unsolved murder, that kidnapped murder in Colorado or in El Paso County, outside of Colorado Springs, Colorado, where he was able to take the same physical evidence that had been there all along on a cold case that was 4 years old and had languished, of a young girl by the name of Heather Dawn Church. And within 11 weeks, he had that suspect identified in custody, and that suspect ended up pleading guilty to this first-degree murder and later pled guilty to a second count of first-degree murder. And that was all Lou Smith's work with he and his team of detectives.
You also chronicle another case where you say that evil came to Colorado Springs in 1975 with Freddie Lee Glenn and Michael Corbett, and that one of these victims was Karen Grammer, Kelsey Grammer's sister, and that Lou had connected the crimes of Glenn and Corbett, and which were five murders. Tell us a little bit about Lou and his involvement in this case.
A very tragic case where Erin, Kelsey Grammer's younger sister, had a job here in Colorado Springs at a restaurant, and a group of African-American armed robbers came in to rob the restaurant, left without any money. And Karen, who was dating one of the other employees there, one of the cooks, was waiting for him to get off. And as the robbery suspects were leaving the restaurant, they abducted Karen. And she was brutally raped and murdered. And this was one of a string of cases that these suspects were involved in. And I was only on the scene on one of these. I was a young rookie police officer by that time. And I, of course, knew Lou from the time I'd been a police cadet. But Lou was one of the detectives on one of the scenes that I was present at. But he had the ability, you know, to look at the evidence on all of these different cases. I think there were five that he ended up linking together with the same group of suspects, most of whom were, at the time, Fort Carson soldiers. Fort Carson is a large military base here in the Colorado Springs, Colorado area. And ended up getting convictions on both Corbett and Glenn. And the reason I kind of bring out those earlier cases is to show the complexity of the investigations and his capability of a detective to see things that a lot of other detectives, myself included, may have overlooked. And he had the experience and knowledge to apply those investigative skills on cases successfully. So when he was hired to be part of the Boulder District Attorney's Office Ramsey Task Force, he brought all that experience with him. And that was sorely needed because the Boulder Police Department did not have experienced homicide detectives. For people not familiar with Boulder, Colorado, it's a bedroom community outside of Denver, Colorado, the state capital. It's a beautiful community. It has the state, Colorado State University is there, a large campus. There's some high-tech industry there, but it's a smaller community where you don't get a lot of major crimes, to include homicides.
Now, you just mentioned that Lou Smith's involvement with Boulder, Colorado Police Department and this task force, the Ramsey Task Force. Tell us where you are in your career at that time. You talked about that you gained invaluable experience being involved with Lou, seeing how he operated from the beginning right to the conviction, through the entire process, even the following two perpetrators we talked about, he had asked you to come along to that interview. So very, very interesting how involved you were in learning from Lou Smith. Tell us about the circumstances in which he is involved with the Ramsey case and what is his belief initially about the Ramseys and their guilt?
Good question. And let me try to wrap that up with the belief that he had going in, and I know this because we talked about this, when he was hired for being interviewed by Alex Hunter, the Boulder District Attorney, Lou had used me for reference. So, and he gave me a heads up that, hey, Johnny, you might be getting a call from the Boulder DA. I put you down as a reference. They're putting together this task force, and they need a couple of experienced investigators. So I was happy to give a reference to the Boulder DA. At that time, I had been elected the sheriff in El Paso County. Colorado Springs is the county seat. Boulder is about an hour and a half kind of north and a little west of where I lived at the time. And when I became the sheriff in 1994, I was elected. I started January 10th of 95, and Lou became my captain of detectives. Unfortunately, his wife, Barb, had been diagnosed with cancer and was undergoing some treatment. So Lou ended up retiring from the county, from the sheriff's office. He had already previously retired from the police department, as had I. And so he had gone into retirement. When the Boulder DA called him, he was Alex Hunter, the DA, lured Lou out of retirement to be a part of this task force. So going in, before Lou started first day with the task force, he and I had talked when he gave me a heads up that the DA may be calling me. And we both thought, again, just from limited information from the media and what the police department had put out, that this was probably going to be a pretty straightforward case. It sounded like initially that it had to have been a family member, you know, since there was reportedly no footprints in the snow, no forced entry. And what Lou said is, well, you know, I think it's probably just a matter of sorting through who in the family was responsible. But, you know, within probably a week or two, it wasn't very long. Actually, the next time I spoke to Lou, I asked him how things were going in Boulder. And the first thing he said is, Johnny, there's something wrong with this case. He said, the evidence doesn't match up with what we're being told. And the more he got involved in the case, the more he was perplexed with what is being told by the police to the media and to the public and to other law enforcement was not at all the truth. There was forced entry into the home in the basement. There was no footprints in the snow on the south side of the house because the snow had melted. In Colorado, when you have a southern facing a home or business, the sun warms the snow there more quickly than on the shaded side. So the snow had already melted. And Lou came to the belief that there had to have been an intruder who came into the home. And when he brought that to the attention of the Boulder detectives, they were incensed. He was not going along with what their theory had been. It was a family member. And whenever he pointed out physical evidence to the contrary, he was dismissed and really chastised for not going along with what they were saying. I know I'll be criticized too by Boulder and other law enforcement agencies for speaking out. But Lou had the courage to say, this is just not right. He worked the case as long as he could tolerate it for a year and a half. But when the Boulder grand jury was being impaneled to indict the parents, Lou resigned in protest. And he wrote a letter, a very heartfelt letter to the district attorney, Alex Sennard, who had hired him. And he said, I just cannot be a part of this injustice. He said, it just is unethical. And so he resigned in protest and had to fight his way to get in to testify at the grand jury.
Let's go back. Let's unwind this story and go back to the fateful December 26, 1996. 5:52, Patsy Ramsey calls 911. Tell us what the family had done on Christmas Day, where they had gone. You talk about the plans that they had for Disneyland a few days later. Tell us where the family was at beforehand and what happens at 5:52. And what is the first response from Boulder Police Department?
And I'm happy to, and I might qualify this, that in deciding to write this book about 2 years ago, I realized that I was in a unique position to write this. Not only had I known Lou personally and been involved on the fringe of the investigation since he was first brought in, but the family, through the Smith family team that I'm still a part of, I was given unrestricted access to his investigative notes and his presentation. He put together an extraordinary spreadsheet, very detailed. The family was so supportive of this book and helping get the truth out there that I had unrestricted access to 632 slides that he had put together in his lifetime, a spreadsheet of 883 columns, I mean, rows of 54 columns of each of these spreadsheets. This spreadsheet, each of the cells, over 47,000 potential pieces of information. The report, the Boulder Police report on this investigation is over 100,000 pages. And he had all of this information on his computer and his investigative notes. And so what I realized was what he left behind, his legacy, was this investigation that now I was in a unique position to write about. I had been with him on so many of these cases. So got to the point where I felt, you know, that the family deserves this information to come out. Public deserves to know the truth. And if I don't write this story, well, then who is? I apologize, Dan. I kind of went off on a tangent there, and I don't know that I answered your question originally, but can you respond and get me back on track if I took us off on a sidebar?
Well, I'm glad you did. You did indicate that based on Lou Smith's comprehensive and extraordinary note-taking, along with these slides, the amount of slides that he has that are on the Wild Blue Press website for people to see, from that, you were able to go back to December 26, 1996, see what the Boulder police response was initially, and see how this tragedy unfolded. Tell us about 5:52 and Patsy Ramsey's call to 911 and what happens when Boulder police respond.
Thank you, Dan, for getting me back. And I should make sure that I'm not overstating what's on the Wild Blue Press website. Just www.wildbluepress.com. What's on there are 20 slides of Lou's the book has an additional 36. So it's only 56 slides of his 632 slide presentation that he put together. The other unique thing that I have is Drew Liu. He introduced me to both Patsy and John Ramsey. Patsy passed away 4 years after the murder at the age of 49. But I have since then been in contact with John Ramsey, as well as his son, John Andrew Ramsey. And so I'm in a unique position when someone might make a statement based upon secondhand information, rumors, speculation, again, I'm in a unique position because I know the story that you're asking about at 5:52 a.m. on December 26, 1996, not only through Lou's lens as a promising detective and having studied this case for the last 26 years, but I've also heard this story from John Ramsey, JonBenet's father.
Yes.
As the family wakes up that morning, Patsy, the mother, goes down it's a huge home, three levels above ground and then a basement. And she's going down from the upper level, which is where the master bedroom suite was. As she's going down the spiral staircase on the bottom step, she finds this 3-page ransom note that the killer had left saying that they have their daughter. And if they're not paid this ransom demand, $118,000, then she'll be murdered. And so she runs upstairs to the second floor, which is where JonBenet's bedroom was, finds the bed empty, screams out. John Ramsey, who is upstairs in the master bedroom, comes down. They search the house. They can't find her. Immediately, John Ramsey tells Patsy, call the police, while he's searching, the rest of the home. And to also fill in your question about what the family had been doing that day, what they were intending to do, because that's an important part of the story, is on Christmas Day, December 26, 1996, and when they open their presents, just like any family would, that afternoon or evening, they go to a friend's house. They have a nice dinner, and then they come home around 10:30, return home in the car. There's an attached garage floor. JonBenet had fallen asleep, heard it upstairs, puts bed, and then Bert also goes to sleep. He's on that same level. So it's been a long day for them. Christmas Day, everybody is tired, and they're trying to prepare for the next day because they were going to be leaving early in the morning. John Ramsey is a pilot. And he would, at the time, his own plane, and they were going to fly to their vacation home. And the four Ramseys, John, Patsy, JonBenet, and Bert, they were going to catch a commercial flight from Denver to Florida, where they were going to board the Disney boat for a cruise. So there was a lot of exciting time ahead that they had been planning.
So, John, tell us about the initial search by police, what they discover, before we talk about the subsequent searches of the Ramsey home.
Very good. The first responding officer is Officer French from the Boulder Police Department. When he arrives within minutes of the 911 call, he's handed the kidnapping note. He takes a brief look at it. Then he searches the home, does not open the door downstairs in the basement where JonBenet's body was found, but he was there in the basement and he saw that door. And for whatever reason, did not unlock it and go inside. He called for assistance. One of the good things that happened is there's other officers, supervisors, and the crime lab that arrives. And they do photograph the scene early on. And those photographs were important for Lou to be able to determine that there was a window standing open in the basement. It was a window that had been previously opened by John Ramsey months earlier when he had been locked out of the home. And Lou saw that there was this large green suitcase propped up below the window that he theorized might have been used by the suspect in exiting the home. So there was some good photography at the crime scene that was used later on.
Where was the suitcase from? And what was found inside that suitcase?
The suitcase, all of the luggage of the family was in the basement, but it was not in that position. And so when John Ramsey was asked by Detective Arndt to take one other person who was in the home and search the house from top to bottom, when he went into the basement with this other neighbor, this is now 7 hours after the 911 call, but when John Ramsey went down the basement with the other gentleman, he pointed out that that window was standing open. He said, that's the window that I got in that I'd broken before. And he said, that suitcase wasn't there. That doesn't belong there. Inside the suitcase was two important things. That was not JonBenet's suitcase, but inside was one of her Barbie dolls and one of her favorite books, a Dr. Seuss book. And what Lou theorized is that the suspect had intended to remove JonBenet from the home by being inside that suitcase. And when he was preparing that, he obviously wanted her to have a book and a doll. And so Lou believed that she was alive when that suitcase was positioned below that window. But for whatever reason, whether or not they weren't able to get the window, the suitcase through the window, but that's an important part of showing that there was an attempt to kidnap the little girl.
Now, this ensuing 7 hours, they look at the ransom note. They look at the gist of the ransom note, which directs them to the specific amounts of money, $118,000. And you write, when John was asked what the $118,000 might be, that specific amount, that was, there was blank checks or there was indications of that amount of money, which was a bonus for that year of his work, so that the perpetrator could have seen some evidence of that specific number, $118,000. So they were arranging, he was arranging to get that money in that ensuing 7 hours before he was asked by a friend and the detective Arndt to go search the house once again. He opened that door that had not been previously opened, and he discovered JonBenet on her back, her hands tied with sort of a string-like material and a black duct tape on her mouth. Tell us what he does, and as a result, obviously contaminates this crime scene.
Yes, and tragically, one of the biggest mistakes that was made by the police early on was not locking down that crime scene and preserving the crime scene. There were people right. that were allowed in, family members roamed throughout the house. The ransom note was passed around to different people. The family's priest was allowed into the home, and detectives came and went. Crime scene people came and went. Nobody looked into that behind that door for 7 hours until Detective Arndt asked John Ramsey to take one other man that was there, a friend, and search the home. The paycheck stub, I should mention that. Ramsey was paid a bonus at the beginning of the year for the $118,000, and that amount was on each of the paycheck stubs that was subsequently printed throughout the year. Since this was the end of the year, there were paycheck stubs, John explains, throughout the house. So anybody could have looked at that paycheck stub and seen that amount, $118,000. That was his best guess of where that amount came from. Other than that, it really had no value to him.
Now, the thing that Lou Smith noticed, there was other evidence outside that he thought was pursuant to the injuries that JonBenet had experienced. So tell us about the baseball bats.
Lou, in reviewing the crime scene photos on the exterior of the home that were taken that morning before the body was found, he noticed an aluminum baseball bat, a black one, that was along the foundation on the north side of the house. Where he thought that may be of significance was the day after the murder. During the autopsy, the coroner found that his determination was that she died through asphyxial strangulation, but also had a severe fracture to the right side of her skull that ran from the front to the back, 8-inch skull fracture. Another expert had later determined that it was equivalent to person falling off a 3-story building and landing on their head. What Lou believed is that it had to have been inflicted such a violent blow, probably had some kind of a blunt object. And when he saw that photo of the baseball bat near the butler door on the north side of the house, he thought that was significant for two reasons. The butler door on the morning of the 26th was found to be unlocked, did no forced entry, didn't know if it was unlocked the night before, one of the neighbors, one of the officers unlocked that door and left it open. But when you go in that butler door, Lou pointed out that the spiral staircase where the note was found was very close to that butler door. So he thought that was significant. There's a second baseball bat that Lou noticed in the exterior crime scene photos taken that morning on the south side of the house. Now, the Ramseys were asked, are those baseball bats yours? And they said, no, neither of the baseball bats were theirs. They didn't recognize them. However, they did say it's not beyond the realm of possibility that some of the neighbor kids who came over and loved to play with Burke and JonBenet, that they might have brought the baseball bats over there, but they thought that they were not part of any of the toys that the family owned. So Lou thought that baseball bat, especially on the north side, could be very significant.
Let's talk about the immediately the Boulder Police Department and their conclusions as to what happened, which informs how they proceed.
Within 4 days, the case detective and supervisors, but one of the detectives, Tom Trujillo, was filling out a lab request for the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, CBI. And at the top, this is dated 12:30 of 96, so 4 days after the murder. He's filling out the lab request form and puts at the top that it is JonBenet Ramsey is the victim. The suspects are Patsy Ramsey and John Ramsey, and puts the offense as willful kill, homicide, family. So immediately within 4 days of the murder, the detectives had reached the conclusion that the parents were responsible for that murder. And what's tragic is on the 15th of January, 1997, so within 3 weeks of the murder, the lab report came back on those articles that were submitted for biological testing as well as other lab examinations. But the fingernail scrapings that were obtained during the autopsy on the 27th of December 1996, as well as the panties that JonBenet was wearing, does identify DNA that excluded the Ramsey family, specifically John Ramsey, Burke Ramsey, Patsy Ramsey, a total of 10 people whose DNA blood was submitted. One of those people that's named on that report is Patsy Ramsey. What's sad is on that same day, December 30th, 1996, the Boulder Police Department is holding a press conference. And during the press conference, the Public Information Officer, PIO, makes the statement that they had obtained blood samples from all of the Ramsey family except for Patsy Ramsey. And the PIO makes some kind of a comment about perhaps she was too distraught to comply. Well, that's a lie. That is not true. And they knew it was not true because the detective who's in charge of the evidence has just submitted a form with all of their names, submitted the biological samples. So one of two possibilities, either the PIO just misspoke and it's an inadvertent mistake, or it was a deliberate intentional distortion of the truth. Now, had it been an unintentional mistake, somebody should have stepped forward either during that press conference or immediately after and say, wait a minute, we have to do a correction. You know, we did have her sample, but that was not done. So it implies that this was a deliberate intentional attempt to use the media and provide this information to the public in an effort to coerce a confession or a statement or cooperation from the parents.
Let's use this, John, as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Despite what you may have read, this spring there will be a hiring boom for many industries, including e-commerce, healthcare, and surprise, the hospitality industry. One of the areas set to see the biggest growth is in service positions, managerial, and back office operations positions. If you need to hire qualified candidates ASAP for any of these industries or any other industry, you need ZipRecruiter. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. How does ZipRecruiter help you grow your team? By utilizing ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology to find the right qualified candidates for the exact role you have for them. When you spot a candidate who'd be perfect for your job, ZipRecruiter makes it easy to send them a personal invite, making them more likely to apply. Let ZipRecruiter keep your team growing strong no matter what the industry. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we talked about the philosophy that Lou Smith had, and of course, subsequently you have, is that the belief that the perpetrator brings things to the crime scene and then takes things away from the crime scene. Tell us what Lou Smith investigated in terms of what was left and what, more importantly, the killer took with them.
What Lou pointed out was there were several items of physical evidence left at the crime scene that had to have been brought by the suspect into the home, specifically the black duct tape that was found over JonBenet's mouth. It had been torn on both sides. It was about a 4 or 5 inch strip of duct tape, but instead of being cut, it was torn. Why that's important is if you're going to find the roll of duct tape that was torn, that was used before and after that piece was torn. You could mate those together, but nowhere in the Ramsey home were there any black duct tape rolls found ever. Secondly, was the white parachute cord known as paracord 550 that was used by the suspect to tie JonBenet up their wrists with a slip knot, and then also a separate piece used to fashion the garrote that she was strangled with. There was no other parachute cord found anywhere in the home. That was another item that had been brought in. The other thing that Lou did was he showed that there were two marks, wound patterns, one on the right side of JonBenet's cheek, on the right side below her ear, and the other one on her back. And Lou believed those were made by a stun gun. Well, there was no stun gun in the possession of the Ramseys. They had never bought one. They didn't know anybody who owned a stun gun. There was not one found in the crime scene or anywhere in the home by the police. So that was another item that Lou said had been brought into the crime scene by the suspect. And he also took that item with him when he left. But the most important thing that he took with him, Lou pointed out, was his DNA. He left DNA both into the fingernails, on the panties, and then later in 2008, another lab report verified that there was touch or trace DNA that was compatible with the DNA on the fingernails and the panties that was found on JonBenet's long johns that she was wearing for pajama bottoms. So there's three sources of DNA that was compatible with one another in 2008 that excluded the family. It also came back and showed it was male DNA.
You also mentioned that there was a boot print left by the body in that wine cellar.
Yes, Lou thought that was significant because this high-tech boot print was right next to JonBenet's body, and it was very crisp, very clean, so it didn't look like it had been there very long. But all of the first responders, the lab personnel who had been there, their footprint, their footwear was checked, as was all of the footwear in the Ramsey household. And there was no high-tech footwear being worn by any of those people. So Lou theorized that it's probable that the suspect who entered the home, it was wearing high-tech boots.
Now, let's get to the explanation of, despite what Lou Smith has already found, what already has been determined about the DNA itself, basically excluding the entire Ramsey family. And this idea that Lou points out, all of these things that were not found, any evidence was found of duct tape or parachute cord or high-tech boots or stun gun or any evidence to point that the Ramseys had anything to do with the assault itself in terms of all this things were missing from the home. It makes no sense where they would have gone to if they were in that home and it was searched thoroughly. Let's talk about how Lou wants to make a presentation to the prosecutor in this case and how a grand jury was impaneled and the results.
Yes, Lou was adamant that the grand jury should hear all of the evidence in this case and not just certain parts of the evidence that would omit any possibility of an intruder theory, intruder coming into the home. So what Lou had to do was, this was right after he left the Boulder DA's office after the grand jury was impaneled by the special prosecutors. And Lou wrote a letter to the grand jury foreman asking permission to come in and speak and show some of his slide presentation to the grand jury. And he said in his letter that there's evidence here of an intruder that needs to be shown. Instead, the special prosecutor for the grand jury contacted Lou and said, "You're not going to be allowed to testify for the grand jury. And we want all of your case reports and the slide presentation back. You shouldn't have any of that information." Lou had to he attained legal services through two attorneys pro bono. They didn't charge him for this, but they represented Lou and argued that the information Lou had, he didn't take anything from the Boulder police or the DA's office. They already had that. He just had copies of the autopsy report, copies of the crime scene photos, copies of different documents, police reports that came from their file and CBI reports, for example. So what the decision was, since these were already in the possession of the Boulder police, the decision was made that he would be allowed to testify. He asked for 3 hours, only gave him 2 hours, not sure which slides he got to present in that limited amount of time. But he did get to fulfill his request to testify. He later told me that it was a very difficult, challenging examination and presentation. He said he was never more rudely treated by an attorney or by members of the grand jury as he experienced during that session.
Now, what is stated in that grand jury decision?
The grand jury transcripts have never been released. And we've tried as our team, our Smith family team, to obtain them. Different attorneys have attempted to obtain copies of the grand jury transcripts to no avail. They've never been shown to the public, which is wrong. We should know what the grand jury transcripts say. What we were told was there were indictments against both Patsy Ramsey and John Ramsey for some, it wasn't for homicide, it was some lesser crime, willful, something about, I don't have it here in front of me, but subjecting the child to dangerous situation or something right. like that. Those charges were never filed. So the grand jury returned a true bill, which is why Lou could talk about it, but the parents were never charged with those crimes. Primarily, in Lou's belief, was that they couldn't be proven. In fact, the district attorney said during a press conference that the grand jury has concluded their investigation, but there's no evidence to substantiate any wrongful doing. But what the DA knew was that the parents were represented by a major law firm out of Denver, and no doubt the district attorney knew their star witness was going to be Lou Smith. And this was a case that against the parents that could not be proven. But the statute of limitations expired after 3 years. So that's another reason why we think the grand jury transcripts should be released.
Now, you read about what happens afterwards, and you go to February 23rd, 2000, and a Perfect Murder, Perfect Town TV miniseries broadcast by CBS. Tell us a little bit about this and why you've included some of this information.
There's been several documentaries, articles, books like mine that have been written. One of the ones that did get a lot of exposure was Lawrence Schiller's Perfect Murder, Perfect Town. And in that one, there were different people, including Lou Smith, who had a major role that was played by an actor. In this case, Kris Kristofferson was selected to portray Lou Smith. And as he was going in to be filmed for this role, Kris Kristofferson wanted to meet Lou and flew into Colorado Springs. I was there when Lou met with Kris Kristofferson. We spent the day together. It was an interesting experience. And that documentary did have a lot of success when it was released.
You write about the continuing effort by Lou Smith and then your eventual involvement. Tell us a little bit about that and how the circumstances in which all that happens, and till we can get to the point where we talk about the extraordinary efforts that Lou continues to do to prove his stun gun theory.
When Lou left the DA's office, he did take all of his investigative files, notes, his computer that contained a lot of the documents and photos with him. And then he continued on his own to investigate this case, attempting to identify the suspect. One of the things that he did after he left the DA's office was to continue to try to prove that it was a stun gun that was used. And the importance of that cannot be understated or overstated, because in Lou's mind, that went to prove the intent of the killer was to immobilize, not to kill, but to immobilize the victim in the home, which goes with the kidnapper ransom intent. So Lou ended up doing to prove that it was a stun gun was he purchased an adult-sized pig, a full-grown pig, in with a coroner out of the Denver metro area, had the pig euthanized, and then applied a stun gun. He found a stun gun of the same make and model that he theorized was used, and used the pig to recreate the stun gun marks, which came back identical to what was shown on JonBenet's back. The distance between the two probes on the stun gun is important. Measures 3.5 centimeters between the two probes, which did identify a air taser stun gun that had been used. And Lou was able to acquire that exact model.
Now, tell us about the effort that Lou does to still approach Boulder Police Department, especially given his focus on this DNA. He believes that the Ramseys have been exonerated by virtue of this DNA, and technology advancements make Lou believe that this should be definitely tested. tell us about his efforts to approach the Boulder Police Department and offer his services.
Yes, throughout the rest of his life, until he passed away in 2010, Lou continued, even though he wasn't paid to be on the DA task force any longer, on his own time and his own expense. He wasn't working for financial gain. He was working really to help solve this case. And so he continued to send emails and what he called darts. And he would like send a little dart into the Boulder police to say, you know, this person here, their DNA needs to be checked. And he kept on his spreadsheet of 883 entries, what, a four-tier system. So as he learned more about an individual, they would move up to the top tier. So he continued until he passed away of feeding this information to the district or to the police department and trying to get them to follow some of these leads. The problem he had was that the parents still remained under, quote, the umbrella of suspicion with Boulder police detectives. And any time that Lou or anyone else would try to say, you know, maybe these other people should be looked at, there was just this pushback from the Boulder police. We felt that too as a team after Lou had passed away. Our Smith family team met with the Boulder law enforcement on two occasions, and we felt the same thing. Every time we brought up somebody that should be pursued, there was just, it was met with a lack of any interest at all.
You write about the extraordinary relationship that was developed between John Ramsey, Patsy Ramsey, and Lou Smith, and also that you were able to meet with Patsy once and meet with John as well.
Yes, I'm not sure why. I was still the sheriff of El Paso County, and there was a meeting in Colorado Springs with an attorney who Lou was very close to, and John and Patsy Ramsey were both attending that meeting. And Lou pulled me aside and he says, hey, John, I want you to go to this meeting with me because I want you to meet John and Patsy Ramsey. I said, well, I'll be happy to do that. I didn't realize that'd be the only time I got to meet Patsy, because shortly after that is when she cancer returned, and then she died shortly thereafter. But Lou had established a very close relationship with John and Patsy for two reasons. Not only were they grieving parents and had firsthand information on this case, but Lou also wanted to make sure that he kept that line of communication open so that he could, on a person of interest, he could call them and say, you know, was this person here ever employed by Access Graphics, John's Ramsey's business? So he purposely kept that line of communication open. When Patsy was diagnosed with cancer and was in hospice in Atlanta, Lou flew from Colorado Springs to Atlanta to spend a little bit more time with her about this case, hoping some information might come out that, you know, would have been lost. So he documented very carefully each of those meetings that he had with Patsy Ramsey, and also with John Ramsey.
This is as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The idea of what was learned, you talk about best practices and lessons learned with this particular case, but you also were so involved with Lou Smith that you were asked by the family to do the eulogy. And very important, you include what you did have to say about this very important figure in your life.
Yes, I was honored to be asked to represent Lou's other homicide detective partners, to include Dave Spencer, who had a major role after Lou passed away in trying to continue his best friend and partner's work, Lou. And the book is dedicated to Lou Smith and Dave Spencer. And without Dave's support, I don't know that we'd ever gotten as far as we have. Dave passed away also to cancer on the 24-year anniversary of JonBenet's death, December 26th, 2020, and left a real void with our team. And it was one of the other reasons why I decided I needed to get this book written. I'd relied so heavily on Dave with his thoroughness of documenting our interviews, surveillances, reports, that when he was gone, right before he passed away, in fact, our last face-to-face conversation, he asked me to come over to his house and pick up his notes in his case file. He had a three-ring binder that he'd put together. And so I decided that I needed to make concentrated effort in getting this case documented as best I could in this book form, knowing that, you know, as this may be my best opportunity to do that as well.
You chronicled that Lou was adamant he would be involved with this right to his dying day. And so he made appearances on with Barbara Walters in an interview and Larry King. And despite those appearances and all of the incredible evidence that he was able to bring forth in those interviews, still the narrative was not what Lou Smith would have liked, was it?
It was not. It seemed like whenever he tried to bring this evidence out through media, Katie Couric or Larry King or Barbara Walters, the interviewers certainly, you know, understood Lou's credibility, his credentials, what he was trying to communicate. But Boulder police were continually resistant of any possible intruder theory, despite all of the physical evidence. And we experienced that too, our team. That was another reason I felt that the book need to be written, because I'm not so sure that Boulder police really understand their case all that well. I think that there's been so much misinformation, disinformation, and it's such a complex case with over 100,000 reports. I think that there may be some misperceptions or misinformation within the Boulder law enforcement community. Do they know that this DNA excluded the family? Was that report well known? I know Lou was still at the district attorney's office in Boulder when it came to light, but that was like 6 or 7 months after it was turned over to the police. So has something happened to some of the evidence, to some of the reports? How retrievable is that information? For example, Lou knew that there were a total of 5 forensic handwriting examiners who looked at the note, the ransom note, and had varying results. Some said that they couldn't exclude Patsy. One in particular said, and I think this gets misinterpreted, that she may have written the note. And then that gets represented that she did write the note. But there were other examiners who said they couldn't confirm that she had written the note. But there was a really important one that Lou had identified, a forensic examiner, who gave his expert opinion that Patsy Ramsey was not the author of the note. She did not write the note. But this is another thing that I think Lou brought out that other people just either didn't know or ignored, was that the Ramseys both took and passed polygraph examinations by one of the leading polygraph operators in the U.S. at the time. And one of the questions that was asked both of them was, do you know who murdered JonBenet? And they said no, and they passed that question. But a specific question that went to Patsy was, did you write the note? And she said no and passed that part of the examination, that results that were validated by an independent polygraph operator. Now, I know people say, well, you know, polygraphs can't be used in court, and that's why they're not admissible. Had both of the parents failed the polygraph examination, everybody would have said, well, see, you know, that shows that they were involved. Now, as a detective, we use polygraphs and the results of the polygraphs fairly extensively on major cases. But what we always knew was, well, you have to confirm what the polygraph says with the physical evidence. So when we have forensic examiners, such as what Lou had found out, or he's now retired, a U.S. Secret Service handwriting expert who said Patsy did not write the note, and then she passes a polygraph and she did not write the note. How much of that information is known to Boulder law enforcement and known to the public? And those are things that Lou tried to communicate through the various appearances that he did on different shows and TV shows and through documentaries, but it was ignored. So what I've tried to do is continue Lou's work and continue to get the truth out there in the written form, in publishing some of his slide presentations to give references, not just an opinion that he had, but what's the original source? What's the physical evidence show us?
You also talk about, really, and I'd like to ask you, how do you, because you did make this presentation to Boulder Police Department with your team with this incredible amount of evidence, how do you explain, especially the resistance to retest DNA utilizing new genetic genealogy. You say it's just a phone call. That all he would have to do is make a phone call.
Yeah. I can't explain that. As our team, our Smith family team, the Boulder DA and two detectives from PD came to that meeting. It was hosted in the DA's office. Michael Doherty is the district attorney still. And we thought that was a fairly positive meeting. We left them information that was actionable, but then we never heard anything. We'd offered to come up and go through Lou's slide presentation. That offer was ignored. So what we did is we took the initiative and I sent a meeting request back to the Boulder DA and the police requesting a second meeting. The district attorney did return that email and he said that any future meeting request would have to be coordinated through Commander Tom Trujillo of the Boulder Police Department. Right. Schedule the meeting. If I'm available, I'll try to stop by. So the second meeting was at the Boulder Police Department with Commander Trujillo, Commander Goss, and the district attorney was able to. And during that meeting, this was during COVID, so we kept our team presence minimum. Just Cindy Smith, Marv, and I were in a parent representative. But we did offer to come back up and go through Lou's slide presentation in detail. We offered to give him his hard copies of all 632 slides. We gave them actionable information. We gave them our top 20 list of persons of interest. We gave them a list of the independent eliminated through DNA collection testing efforts. I think there was probably 8 or 9 on that confidential list at that time. We shared with them the other people that we were focusing to their cooperation and their trust, and they refused any future meetings. They just completely cut off all phone email exchanges to the point that after some time when Commander Trujillo refused to return my emails or phone calls, I put a police chief, Mavis Harrell, and specifically asked for a meeting with her. And she wouldn't even give me the courtesy of a return phone call.
Now, despite that, the Smith family team continues. What is your goal with this book? And what is your goal with this investigation that continues?
What our Smith family team hopes to do, and this is Lou's life work, is to communicate through the physical evidence, the undeniable proof that no member of the Ramsey family was involved in the murder of John Bedet. Point one. Point two is that this case is still solvable. The DNA that was there, the genetic markers can rule people out, not just the Ramsey family, but it can be used in a variety of ways. Now, we don't know the state of the DNA evidence because the police won't release. We do have the genetic markers that Lou had initially. There were 10 genetic markers in 97. Since then, in 2008, there were additional 4. So there's at least 14 genetic markers. But there are advances being made every day in DNA technology with private labs. When we last met with Boulder Police, we gave them the names, phone numbers, email addresses of 3 private labs that were willing to step forward and help with the investigation. We've stayed in touch with those 3 private labs. They have never been contacted. Our team even offered to pay for the testing through our GoFundMe page. And that request has been denied as well. One of the other important things that happened in December 6th of last year of 2022, Boulder Police disclosed a media release of results of an internal investigation that showed that Detective Tom Trujillo and 4 other investigators were being disciplined for misconduct, and specifically not investigating or thoroughly investigating their caseload. They did not say that it was the John Bonet case, but there was discipline to include Commander Trujillo being removed from the supervisor over the investigations division and put on midnights in patrol. What we hope to do, and after that meeting, I sent another meeting request to the police chief as well as the DA and the commanders involved with Boulder Police on the investigation, asking for a meeting, and gave them to the end of January of 2023 to respond. They never called, never returned my email, never accepted our request for a meeting. Helped share with them the evidence that clearly shows that the Ramsey family are not involved and that this DNA can be used to eliminate additional persons of interest and hopefully identify who the threat is.
I want to thank you so much, John Wesley Anderson, for coming on and talking about your book, Lou and John Bonet, a legendary lawman's quest to solve a beauty queen's murder. I want to applaud you for this book and for your extraordinary effort and all obviously chronicling the incredible story of legendary Detective Lou Smith.
Thank you, Dan.
Do you have a website that people might refer to? Tell us about that.
Thank you. Yes, I have. Probably the site for this case is my publisher, wildbluepress.com. And I have a separate website that does not have anywhere near the information that the publishers do. My website is jwander.com. My initials, jwander.com.
Thank you so much, John Wesley Anderson, Lou and JonBenet, a legendary lawman's quest to solve a beauty queen's murder.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening. Good night.